You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the grade school art assignment lives on through a new book that asked contemporary artists to give us adults some fun homework. We'll talk to the creator of the PBS video series, The Art Assignment, coming up. Now, demonstrators in Madison tore down two statues outside the Capitol building last night, and a small group attacked State Senator Tim Carpenter of Milwaukee. The crowd was protesting the arrest of an African-American man by Madison police yesterday afternoon. Today, Governor Evers says he's reactivating the National Guard to assist police in handling protests in Dane County. He tweeted that individuals behind violence will be held accountable, but that he also doesn't want last night to make people forget why demonstrations are happening in the first place. Dylan Brogan is a staff writer for Isthmus in Madison. He was covering the protests last night. Dylan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Before we get to yesterday, Dylan, can you talk about what's happened in Madison since the initial round of protests? Have protests been carrying on pretty steadily since then?
Absolutely. Nearly daily protests, particularly centered around downtown Madison, around the Dane County Jail and around the Capitol. And there have been a number of demonstrations where activists have blocked traffic and done some civil disobedience to get their message across about police violence. And what we saw last night was sparked by, like you said, the arrest of a frequent activist who has been part of this movement that has been growing for the last few weeks now.
Break it down for us what happened yesterday afternoon that they were responding to.
Well, there's a video that the police department put out publicly that shows this young man going into a downtown restaurant with a megaphone and having a baseball bat in kind of over his shoulder. And he is confronting people who are in the restaurants. The police were eventually called, and it took a number of officers to put him into the squad car initially, and then he briefly broke free and was tackled and sustained some injuries, as well as some officers sustained some injuries. And then that kind of just sparked a whole night of protests in which people were very upset and demanded that this young man be released from the jail.
So by evening, people, I understand, started to assemble outside the county jail building. What when you got there, what was the tone of the protest like early on?
Well, people were outside the Dane County Courthouse, which is right by the jail and just a block or two down from the Capitol. So this is all in a very small area of downtown Madison. They somehow or whatever, the protesters had kind of gathered around this Schmitz towing truck and weren't letting people. We're basically using it as a stage and stuff. Eventually, the tow truck was pulled away by Schmitz employees, and it had a small amount of damage, and I think the tires were let out. But people were very angry. There was talk of going to the governor's mansion, and eventually this crowd of people made their way up towards the Capitol Square, intent on tearing down the Forward statue at the top of State Street, and then another statue of a Norwegian immigrant who fought in the Civil War. That was also teared down and then thrown into Lake Monona. So it's this group of about 100, 200, 300 protesters who were intent on, at the very least, tearing down these statues. And then there ended up being some other damage to the Capitol and a state building. And then what I witnessed, too, was a state senator, Tim Carpenter from Milwaukee, who just kind of appeared to just happen upon the scene. He had he kind of was in front of the crowd and took a photo. And these protesters were very hostile about people not filming and screaming things like no media. I was pushed to the ground for trying to just take a photo about 100 feet away from a line of protesters who were just standing there with their arms linked. And before the state senator Carpenter could even really respond or even really knew what was going on, about a dozen or 10 people just rushed towards him and started to attack him. He said he was kicked in the face. I watched that. He was punched in the face. He had a bruised eye. And they continued to question him even after the assault. And he was trying to prove to him that he was no threat to them and their ally, but he was very shaken up, and eventually he had to be taken, or an ambulance came because he evidently collapsed on the Capitol grounds shortly after the protesters had moved on.
Talking to Dylan Brogan, staff writer for Isthmus based in Madison, about the protest in Madison around the Capitol Square last night. So what ended up happening through the rest of the night after that incident?
So after that, the protest eventually made its way kind of closer to the Dane County Jail, and then police and riot gear kind of emerged for the first time all evening. Police in Madison, working with other agencies, have really had a hands-off approach where they don't go near protesters, and because it escalates the situation, and there are people there that view this very much as a war, and the police is an aggressor and are willing to stand up and fight up against the police, against tear gas and pepper spray, and hold the line. So that's what ended up happening. But it was about a 90-minute standoff, and there was several announcements by the police that this was an unlawful assembly and that people needed to go home and that they might use chemical agents to disperse the crowd. And so some parts, one organizer, it's very, very hard to tell who's in charge here. It's basically whoever's on a megaphone. One organizer kind of left probably a good 75% of the remaining 100, 200 people to go home. And they did. But around 50 people stayed around for another hour and eventually got the police to agree to leave, and they'd leave. And it all ended peacefully with no tear gas or any real confrontation with the police. But it was very tense there for a good 90 minutes, and that's how things eventually ended. But it was an entire day of really of peaceful protests, of destruction, of all sorts of things happening in downtown Madison.
I want to give a listen to one of the protesters, Ebony Anderson Carter, talking to Madison's News 3 Now this morning about the frustrations she's feeling. Here's a listen.
The Capitol is where we solve problems, but nobody's coming here to solve a problem. There are all these conversations that are being had amongst the people that these conversations don't need to be had with. The conversations need to be had with the youth.
So did you get that sense of frustration from at least some of the protesters that the messages they're trying to send aren't being heard?
Absolutely. People are frustrated that and frankly fed up that they've seen decades of peaceful protests starting with the civil rights movement that they feel have not been acknowledged, or serious action hasn't been made in these efforts. And now that peaceful protest has apparently or evidently seemed to have failed, they're willing to go through the more destructive acts and see this very much as protesting. And I think that's what it gets very complicated when talking about these young protesters, is that they do not share one unified vision, and even the organizers have different tactics that they think need to be abided by. But some people feel like this kind of destruction is needed and necessary in order to provoke real change. And there were at least 100 people who were set to do just that last night.
What are you hearing now? We've heard Republicans critical of the violence and damage and of Governor Evers and Madison's local government. Governor Evers says he's reactivating National Guard. What else are we hearing about possible changes to the way protests get responded to?
Well, that I think tonight could either be very eventful or very uneventful. I think it's unclear how many people exactly are going to show up, and that is very dependent or very telling of what the reaction by police would be, because you have a few hundred protesters, any possibility of arresting everyone or just chaos not breaking out is virtually impossible. But there has been a lot of destruction that's been allowed to happen in order to not have confrontations with protesters. And it seems like the governor and certainly the Republican leadership in state government and the mayor of Madison are taking a new line where they're not going to allow anything but peaceful protests to occur and may be willing to take more assertive action to stop it, or at least preemptive action to stop it.
Dylan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Dylan Brogan is a staff writer for Isthmus in Madison. He talked with us about protests in Madison last night after the arrest of an activist by Madison police. Demonstrators tore down two statues at the Capitol and assaulted State Senator Tim Carpenter of Milwaukee. Coming up, if you can draw a duck or paint a pheasant, we talk to a representative from the state DNR about their latest contest to find game bird stamp art. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you can draw a bird, you could play a big role in helping raise money for wildlife conservation in Wisconsin. We'll find out how. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of a food tradition from a Caribbean island.
Cooking can transport us to another place, another time. When we cook, we're able to keep our family's dishes and memories alive for generation after generation. That's the case for Anne Marie Herman in Madison, who was raised on the island of St. Lucia. WPR's L. Malik Anderson brings us her story about fish cakes. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
The smell of hot oil, jerk chicken, and freshly baked bread with coconut and chocolate chips, Bill Anne Marie Herman's kitchen in Madison. She heats up the oil in a large, heavy cast iron pan over her stovetop. Her ingredients wait on the countertop, ready to be put to work.
This is flour. This is the codfish. It has thyme, onion, garlic, and other spices.
On the menu today, salted fish cakes. She fills the frying pan with as many battered fish cakes as she can at once. After they are all done, she takes them out of the pan and places them on top of a huge pile of more fish cakes. This dish has been a part of Herman's life for a long time.
I was born in the Caribbean islands, St. Lucia. But when I was much younger, I used to cook for my older brothers. That's how I started cooking, real cooking.
Herman grew up in the countryside with her mother and would go back and forth to the middle of the town to cook for her elder brothers who were taxi drivers.
My brothers were taxi drivers who were in the middle of town driving tourists and stuff, so they don't have time to do anything with cooking, so I used to do the cooking for them. But what my trick was, not using a lot of fat in my food. I didn't use to measure a lot of stuff when I was cooking.
Herman started keeping track of her measurements for each dish when she decided to publish a cookbook of family favorite recipes with a Caribbean twist.
You see inside of it? It has all the Caribbean islands in there. That's my idea of putting the Caribbean foods together.
In her cookbook, she shares recipes for beef patties, fried green plantains, aloha friendship bread. There's also jerk chicken and other dishes her family enjoys.
Fish cakes is another thing I make often. You take codfish, you boil it because it has a lot of sodium in it. So you wash it first, then you put it in a little pot to boil, and then when you give it a few minutes to cook, when it softens, you wash it again. You put more cold water on it to take the salt. Then you shred it and you add spices to it.
She said her fish cakes are always a hit among her friends in the Caribbean Association of Madison.
Sometimes I even try to hide it, but they find it before the meal. And some people will come and say, where is the fritters? They call it fritters. They ask me, where are the fritters you brought? It's there, but when you look, it's gone.
St. Lucia, island of the West.
WPR producer L. Malik Anderson brought us that story on Anne Marie Herman's fish cakes. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, going back to the late 1970s, Wisconsin's DNR has raised money for wildlife and environmental conservation efforts through selling stamps. These stamps were and still are required for hunters pursuing ducks and geese. In the 90s, the DNR added fundraising stamps for hunting wild turkeys and pheasants. And the stamps are an opportunity for Wisconsin artists to share their work. The DNR is still accepting submissions for the 2021 stamp designs. Elena Garretts is the DNR Assistant Upland Ecologist and Stamp Coordinator. Elena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the art, talk about these stamps and how they work to help raise money for conservation.
Yeah, so before pheasant, turkey, and waterfowl hunters go afield, they have to purchase a stamp for the corresponding species. And these stamp funds go directly back into habitat management for those species. And they also get used for programs like education, outreach, and research.
And how big a deal is that when it comes to funding these kind of programs?
It ends up being several hundred thousand dollars per year that goes back into habitat management to create more healthy and robust populations so that hunters have more opportunities.
And where did the idea come from to, you know, not just have a boring stamp with some letters on it, but to actually solicit designs from the public?
Yeah, so I think that we drew a little bit of inspiration from the federal duck stamp competition. They also look for art pieces that are done throughout the country. Ours is exclusive to Wisconsin residents, so it's kind of a cool way for us to promote our own Wisconsin artists, but also promote hunting and conservation.
If somebody's out there listening and thinking, yeah, I can do a good picture of a duck, how can they enter the contest themselves?
So all the rules are on the DNR website, but basically we don't limit the medium. They can do an oil painting, watercolor, pencil, anything that they want. All the rules for submission are online, but they can just send those art pieces in to me. And if they're postmarked before July 15th, they'll be entered into the competition.
And typically, response to a lot of Wisconsin artists send in their renditions?
Yeah, we've had a lot of interest in it. And this year, we actually reached out to a couple of art schools within the state. And so we're getting more submissions from local artists who are also pursuing careers in art. So I think that this year we might have potential to have quite a few art pieces.
All right. So what are the different categories people who are better artists than I am could try to get their pictures on?
So the three categories are wild turkey, pheasant, and waterfowl. And then those will be put on the stamp, that the physical stamps that hunters can receive when they buy their licenses. But then also there's potential for them to be displayed on the DNR website and different publications that we put out, and also at the state fair.
And looking at some of the past winners, do people usually have, you know, one majestic bird in it or flocks, or is it kind of a big mix of things that ends up getting chosen?
It ends up being a really large variety, and I think that's one of the things that's special about it. One of the cool things we've seen last year in the turkey contest was someone actually painted a turkey decoy next to a real turkey, so it simulated sort of that real hunting experience, which I thought was really neat.
Now, are you the sole judge, or who ends up making the decision from all the entries?
Yeah, I actually don't judge at all. I'm impartial. Okay. We invite people that are part of conservation groups, so people from Pheasants Forever, National Wild Turkey Federation, Ducks Unlimited, and other organizations are invited to come down and judge those pieces.
Now, if I enter and win, and I won't, but if I did, do I just get bragging rights? Is there a reward or what?
It's mostly bragging rights, but artists really use that sort of as a leverage and advertisement to sell other pieces. That's really a big feather in their cap, and you also get a commemorative plaque, and sort of you might be distributed in different DNR mailings and on our website as well. So it's a lot of exposure.
And when are the seasons these stamps will be in work? What's roughly the timing of the year for the turkey and waterfowl and pheasant seasons?
So it's mostly in the fall. We have a fall turkey season. Waterfowl and pheasant hunting is in the fall, but then also it's for spring turkey season. So these stamps that we're choosing in the next couple of months will be used for the 2021 season.
And these stamps, if I'm a hunter, how much am I paying for those?
So it varies between stamps, and I don't know all of the prices off the top of my head, but it's somewhere between $5 and $10 for each stamp. It depends per species.
Now, if I've bought one of these stamps, do I have to turn it in at the end to prove I have it, or do I get to keep and collect this artwork from year to year?
Yeah, so we actually don't give out the physical stamps anymore, but you can request them at service stations, and a lot of people are really avid collectors. So there's also opportunities to buy past year stamps for collection.
Oh, cool. Okay, so if people missed in the previous years, they can catch up now. And are there opportunities to get these artworks in larger than stamp form?
Yep, but you would do that through the individual artist. So, like last year's winner, for example, he sells his copies of the state duck stamp himself.
And Elena, I got to ask: have people already been submitting their designs yet, or do they usually wait till the deadline?
Well, normally we get a lot of submissions where it seems like the paint's still drying; they're really late. but we've already gotten quite a few, so I'm hoping to get many more this year.
So we have got a. You think we got a pretty good art community here in the state?
We do. I think we're really lucky in Wisconsin to have a good art community.
Elena, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Elena Garretts, wildlife ecologist with the DNR, their stamp program coordinator. We talked to her today about this contest going on right now to submit art to be on the 2021 Game Bird Stamps. We've got a link, by the way, to the DNR's page with more information about applying. You can find that on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. If you submit for these, or if you've won, a WPR listener, you've won the contest in the past, or if you're a collector of these game bird stamps, as it sounds like some people are, love to hear from you about that. You can show us your collection, email us a picture, ideas@wpr.org, or tweet us at @centraltimewpr. And hey, coming up, a related topic for everyone now, not just the actual artist. If you don't think you're an artist, think again. Our guest says we can all tap into our creative minds. She has lots of suggestions to help us get started. A former museum curator, she's devoted her life to inspiring the rest of us to do artistic stuff, even if we're not going to end up selling it at a museum ourselves. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at a new report on police funding levels around Wisconsin and how they've changed over time. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, you are an artist. That's the title of our next guest's new book and what she believes. Her book includes over 50 different assignments inspired by real contemporary artists she's interviewed. Many don't even require a writing utensil. Just to give you an idea of what some of these are like, let me read the instructions to one of them. This comes from artist Jace Clayton. Step one, go outside and walk in the direction that's the quietest. Step two, continue until you're in the quietest place possible. Step three, take a moment to absorb the silence. Then step four, document your quietest place with a photo or short video or write about it. That is your art. Sarah Ernest Green is a curator, art educator, and creator of The Art Assignment, a PBS video series exploring art history through the lens of the present. She's a former curator of contemporary art at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Her new book is called You Are an Artist, Assignments to Spark Creation. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think I'm like a lot of people, and I think art is a thing that's done by artists and, you know, people who will do stuff at museums and galleries and things like that. And I've kind of given up on most forms of artistic expression. You're trying to help people like me out, it sounds like.
That is very much the case. I mean, I love art proper, formal art. I love art that has taken many years to master and hone various skills for, but the more I was involved in the arts and working in the arts, the more I encountered working artists who were doing other sorts of things and calling it art. And art from that world was very effective. So I think once we all sort of accept that and accept that art can be a walk toward a quietest place, it opens the door for a lot of us to make art and be artists and take away some of that intimidation factor.
What for you, whether you're doing the video series or in your book, what to you makes a good art assignment for the general public?
A good art assignment to me is something that doesn't require expensive materials or a particular talent or skill like drawing, but is something that can be interpreted in different ways. One of our earliest assignments came from the artist David Brooks that was to articulate something that you've never seen and probably never will. Now, you can do that in a lot of ways. We give some examples about how Albrecht Dürer in the 1500s created a drawing and a print of a rhinoceros, even though he'd never seen one and never would. But you could interpret that in a lot of different ways. I know one person who's responded to it had never met their father and had never seen a picture of them. And decided to look at themselves and to look at their mom and create a portrait, a drawn portrait that was a guess at what their father looked like. So, you know, I think there's a good assignment is something that is open to anyone and can be interpreted in many different ways.
You encourage people to not just try this at home, but then to share it back with you and the public and friends. How do we overcome our maybe self-consciousness at this moment of creation?
We do encourage, and I do encourage people to share their work because I think art is a great way to connect with other people. If you're interested in sharing your work and responding to an assignment, we ask that people post what they make to their social media platform of choice with the hashtag #YouAreAnArtist so that I can find it, so that you and your community can see it and appreciate it. And then I could maybe repost it and share it. But of course, you know, if you'd like to make art and keep it to yourself, that's fine too. Sometimes I think you need to tell yourself that you're not going to share it to be able to make it in the first place. And then after you're done, maybe you can make that decision for yourself.
Sarah Urist Green is with us. Her new book is called You Are an Artist, Assignments to Spark Creation. I want to dig into some of the fun ones that that you share in the book. One of them that I liked was taking a photo of a place maybe we see all the time and then coming home and sitting with it for a while and then going back and getting more detailed pictures, digging deeper. Can you talk about this one and what you hope people will take from it?
Yeah, this assignment is titled Blow Up, and it's inspired by the Antonioni film of the same name called Blow Up. And it's offered by the Chicago-based artist Asaf Evron. And what I love about this assignment is that it asks you to take a picture of a scene you pass every day or something you might see out your window. Take a picture of it and then look at it for a long time, for like 3 minutes, which 3 minutes, not that long, but 3 minutes when you're looking at one picture can seem like a super long time. And it's amazing if you give yourself this task, what happens when you do see something for that long, when you explore an image and allow yourself the time to explore an image slowly. And then so like when I've done this, I look at this picture for a long time. And then when I return to that spot, I notice new details that I never had before. I notice a weird crack in the sidewalk. I notice, a randomly repainted brick. And I notice all these strange details that you're then asked to take follow-up pictures of. And, you know, what you end up with may not be museum worthy or may not be something remarkable. But a lot of times I think art is about paying attention. And it's amazing once you do start looking more closely, how rewarding just simply the act of looking can be.
A lot of times, I think when people think about art, they might think about, you know, am I trying to say something or express something? And some of the artists you draw from in the book are doing that. But a common theme in a lot of these projects is the process and that something cool emerges by just doing these things.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, there are several assignments in the book that I've been thinking about a lot lately that are about articulating a message. I mean, our assignment offered by Dred Scott called Statements is, I think, a blueprint for creating your own protest poster. What he asks is for you to think of a big social question that you care about that affects hundreds of thousands or millions of people. Spend time researching the question, reading books or interviewing people, and then come up with a statement or phrase or quote or question of 12 words or fewer that identifies or gets to the heart of that question in some way. And then design a poster, flag, or banner in response. And I think, you know, during this time when so much is going on and it's a time where we all kind of want to think about what we want to say and how we want to say it, I like that this assignment in particular gives us room to explore that and sort of a framework for coming up with what we want to say. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is a lot about the process and, you know, maybe what you make isn't something that you're super proud of, but I think just going through that process and figuring out what it is you want to say is really informative.
Well, I'm loving this picture. I have the book in front of me right now. The artist Kim Beck has a piece called Surface Tests. And this is something we could really easily try at home. I think you say with just a crayon and some thin paper. Tell us how this one works.
Yeah. So an imprint, her assignment, Kim Beck's assignment is, as you said, called Surface Test. And she really spends a lot of time in her practice looking at the ground. And she finds it very interesting to think about in our worlds what we term as natural and unnatural and how we sort of situate ourselves and figure out where we are in the world. And she asks you to, as you said, get some sort of a crayon or writing implement, a crayon with the paper removed or a stick of charcoal if you have it, and a thin piece of paper, and to go outside of where you live, or you can even do it in your house if you don't. I've seen some very successful responses inside the house, and take a rubbing of the ground where you live or near where you live. And then take a picture of that rubbing in place and then share it. So I think, you know, this is the assignment that I chose to start the book because it's sort of a simple grounding, not to be too literal, exercise about figuring out where you are and sort of acknowledging where you are in space and time.
We're talking to Sarah Urist Green about her new book, You Are an Artist, Assignments to Spark Creation. She's also the creator of the PBS video series, The Art Assignment. Did I say you are not an artist? I think I said the opposite of the book title. You Are an Artist is the title of the book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you create or view art, how do you make it work even when you're not feeling most creative? Why is art important to you? Do you do something artistic just for fun? You know, you're not necessarily trying to sell something or get something on a wall in a famous place. You just do it because you like to do it. Love to hear your story, what you do. If you teach art to young people or older people, love to hear how you try to instill that sense of creativity and love of creation. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with art educator Sarah Urist Green, creator of The Art Assignment. That's a PBS video series. Her new book is called You Are an Artist, Assignments to Spark Creation. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do arts or crafts or writing or whatever just for fun, just to embrace your creative side? Maybe even if you're not good at it, tell us what you like to do, why you do it, what you like to make. Maybe you need some inspiration. I'm sure Sarah has some for you. If you teach other people how to do this kind of stuff, love to hear your story as well. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. creativeart.org. Sarah, I hear a lot from people who talk about creativity and art that, you know, when we're kids, we're all artists. We love to draw or cut or paste or whatever. Why do you think so many of us lose that as we grow up?
I think that there's a number of reasons. I don't think our museums do a very good job of telling us that art is something that anybody can do. You know, I think I love museums. I've worked in museums. I think they're wonderful places. But when you see an artwork in a fancy golden frame or up on a pedestal or behind glass, it doesn't look like something a person made. And so I think, you know, the older we get, the more we're exposed to certain kinds of art and worlds of art, and it seems less feasible. It seems less like something we can do. But I also think, you know, I have kids, and I like to art. I like to make art to begin with. But when you have kids, when you're around kids, it tends to reawaken that a little bit for you. And because they're so fearless. And I really admire that about children and young people, how they can just dive into a drawing a lot of times and not care what they're doing. And I think a lot of times it takes that, like, we get, as adults, we get too much in our heads about what something should look like, or what's good and what's bad. And if we just free ourselves up a little bit and say, you know what, I'm just going to try this. It doesn't matter if it's good or bad. You know, that's kind of the secret. Once we can do that, I think we can do a lot of things.
Something you do in the book and on the series as well is connect these projects that we do with existing art and maybe some historical art. So by doing these things ourselves, does it help us appreciate the work of the, you know, capital A artists out there?
I think so. I mean, we have an assignment in the book called Meet in the Middle, and it's these two artists who lived far apart, who decided one day that they were going to meet at the exact geographical midpoint between where the two of them lived. And I think a lot of people might, and they documented the project and shared it in different ways. And I think a lot of people might look at that project and say, "What? Well, you know, that's not art. You know, why is that art?" But if you look back to history and you see what artists have done before, not only a walk toward a quiet place can be art, but there are artists like Marina Abramović and Ulay who did a great wall walk, where they each started at different ends of the Great Wall in the 80s and walked toward each other over the course of many days and many miles. And when they reached the middle of the wall, they ended their multi-year collaboration and said goodbye. So I think it's interesting to give historical context to a lot of these examples. And you know what? If you still think that a walk, even a strategic or metaphorically resonant walk, isn't art, I'm not going to convince you. But if you want to, I think it's a great way of framing certain activities and elevating them and seeing the world in a deeper way.
And that's a big point. And again, a running theme through a lot of the projects is it's all about framing our world in a way and making us maybe think of an ordinary experience in an extraordinary way.
Yeah. And I mean, there's even our technological experiences. I mean, there are assignments in the book that ask you to look at the most recent thing you made a screenshot of on your phone and then to use that image as the basis for an artwork. So, you know, I think we tend to discount a lot of experiences and even sort of images. You know, our world is so full of images, all the ones we see on the internet, on TV, out in the world, on billboards. We're surrounded by them, and there's so much interesting things to unpack that I think that with the right framing and with a few prompts, we can be more alive to it.
Talking to Sarah Urist Green. Her new book is called You Are an Artist's Assignments to Spark Creation. She's got a lot of inspiration from working artists to help us non-working artists, or us non-artists, actually create cool stuff. Let's look at another one of your projects. And I love this one. This is great for people who have, you know, those old torn articles of clothing and whatever that they don't have the heart to throw away but don't know what to do with. Make a rug. Tell us about this one.
That's right. This assignment is offered by the artist Fritz Haig. And in his work, he thinks a lot about how we make a domestic space, how we make our home, what we do, what do we do in our home space that's different from, say, an art gallery or a museum. And one of the things he's done is figure out a way that he likes to turn old T-shirts and old linens that you're not using anymore into a hand-crocheted rug. And you don't need any materials for this except for some old T-shirts. And I know a lot of people who have sort of embarked on this exercise. Say you only have, two or three T-shirts that you have to work with, although I would guess that many of us have more than that. He has this great way of cutting them into strips, and then he will teach you how to hand tie them into this round rug. And you can add to it over time. So say you only have a few, then you've started this thing. The next time you have some bed sheets that wear out, or somebody gives you a T-shirt you don't want, you can add to the rug. And in that way, it grows over time. And when you look at it, you can think about the time that's passed and all the things that sort of contributed to creating it.
Have you seen a lot of people send you pictures of their homemade rugs hung in places of honor?
I have. They're very popular with pets, actually. they tend to be quite thick and cozy, these rugs. And so I've seen hundreds of pictures of people who have made these rugs. And I've actually done a few workshops at some conferences with large groups of people where we've made a rug. One of them was hundreds of pounds, actually. So wow. they can grow to be quite large, or they can be very modest in size.
Well, let's talk a little more about the why. What can most of us get out of this? Again, given that we're not ultimately trying to get on a museum wall or, sell something for six figures, what do we get out of taking this artistic mindset and putting it into practice?
Yeah, well, I think there are so many things that art does. It is not just an expression of the artist's inner mind. It can do that, but it can also do other things. And I think especially right now, it can be a great way of connecting with other people, be it virtually or in person. It can be a way, some of the assignments in the book help you figure out a way to make a creative meal together. Another assignment has you interviewing family members about the makes and models of the cars they've owned. And I think when you think about art more as an experience, more as a process, and more as a way of looking at the world, it makes your life richer and fuller, and gives you a reason to reach out to someone in the very basic sense. And it can also be a way to occupy time. I know sometimes I just want to do something a little bit mindless that occupies my hands. You can make a paper weaving in the way that our artist Michelle Grabner, who's actually based in Wisconsin, does very, very frequently and effectively. So I think in general, it really... the breadth of these assignments shows you that there are so many ways to be an artist, and you shouldn't count yourself out.
And briefly, Sarah, as we wrap up, do you take your work home with you? Do you do a lot of these projects on your own time?
Of course. Of course I do.
Sarah, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Sarah Arist Green. She's a curator, art educator, and creator of The Art Assignment, a PBS video series that explores art history through the lens of the present. She's a former curator of contemporary art at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. We've been talking about her new book. It's called You Are an Artist, Assignments to Spark Creation. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, many people are working from home because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Technology writer Clive Thompson joins the show. He's back with us to tackle the question, what if working from home never ends? How is that going to change the way we work and the way we live? The nation is looking back at past disease outbreaks to find lessons for today. We'll look back at the rise of AIDS, how it affected Wisconsin, and how the state reacted at the time. and an expert on protest movements, joins the show for a look at the ongoing protests against racial injustice and how they compare with movements of the past and how they're being received nationwide. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a Wisconsin infectious disease expert joins the show for a look at the quest for a vaccine for the virus that causes COVID-19. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then UW System President Ray Cross released a blueprint for the UW system beyond COVID-19 that came out last month. We'll talk to a faculty representative from UW Stout with some concerns over that plan. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
WPR has been an important part of Wisconsin for more than 100 years. In the early days, people tuned in for weather reports and crop prices. Today, you tune in for essential news coverage and quality entertainment. Our budget year ends on June 30th, and there's still so much good work to do. Help keep our entire state connected with information, music, and laughter when you give at WPR.org. Thank you.
PBS Wisconsin is proud to offer Bright by Text, a free texting service for parents and caregivers of children ages 8 and younger. Text the word BADGER to 274-448 and receive research-based, age-specific resources and activities from trusted content partners like PBS Kids. Get free educational resources delivered to your phone with Bright by Text from PBS Wisconsin. Just text BADGER to 274-448.
Live from NPR News, I'm Jack Spear. Senate Democrats have blocked consideration of a Republican bill overhauling policing practices. Democrats wanted bipartisan talks before allowing debate.